government regulations, which were created to protect employees, are actually hurting them.
Regulation after regulation.
Until the government understands that they have to create an environment suitable for us to keep growing, we're going to stay in this recession a long time.
The federal government has blocked efforts to expand the ride-sharing.
The owners say the restaurant has succumbed to the crush of government regulations.
We have seen an unprecedented explosion of new regulatory activity.
$1.8 trillion. That's how much business
and bus companies to close.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed. There is red tape that needs to be cut.
The regulations are...
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep...
Is this really the best we can do?
This is Free Lunch, the podcast of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. All expressions of opinion on this podcast are those of the speakers.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another Federalist Society Free Lunch podcast call for the Regulatory Transparency Project. Visit the RTP website at regproject.org, regproject.org, to subscribe to our newsletter and to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. My name is Devin Westhill. I'm the director of the RTP and the host of the Free Lunch Podcast. This Free Lunch Podcast episode examines self-driving vehicles and the challenges posed to such groundbreaking innovation. I think this will be a fun and interesting conversation about market challenges as well as regulatory and legislative hurdles to deploying this technology. Importantly, I hope to delve into what we can expect in the near term regarding the deployment of self-driving vehicles. Our guests today are Jamie Boone and Ryan Hageman. Jamie is the Senior Director of Government Affairs for the Consumer Technology Association, serving as an advocate for the consumer technology industry on Capitol Hill. Her core areas of policy expertise include self-driving vehicles and vehicle technology, privacy, and drones. She's a passionate thought leader on public policy for automated and connected vehicles and has spoken at the Consumer Electronics Show, South by Southwest, and on various policy panels across the D.C. area. Jamie is an experienced legislative and policy professional, having previously served as a longtime aide for Congressman Bill Schuster of Pennsylvania, last acting as his deputy chief of staff. She serves on the board of directors for the Women's High Tech Coalition. Jamie earned her BA from Susquehanna University in Pennsylvania. Ryan is the director of technology policy at the Niskanen Center. His research specialties include regulatory governance of emerging technologies, robotics and automation, privacy and surveillance, and issues at the intersection of sociology, economics, and technology. He's previously authored works on the economic and social ramifications of autonomous vehicles, that is, self-driving vehicles, with the Mercatus Center. Ryan has been published in the Wall Street Journal, Wired, the Washington Examiner, U.S. News and World Report, The Hill, and elsewhere. Ryan earned his BA in International Relations, Foreign Policy, and Security Studies from Boston University, and also earned a Master's in Public Policy and Science and Technology Policy from George Mason University. Ryan is also, very happy to say, a member of the RTP's Emerging Tech Working Group at the Federalist Society. If you'd like to learn more about Jamie or Ryan, please visit regproject.org. As a reminder, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy initiatives, and therefore all expressions of opinion on Free Lunch Podcast are those of our featured speakers. Our guests will take questions after their remarks, so please be prepared with any questions that you might have prior to the start of the Q&A period. Now, okay. Thank you, Jamie and Ryan, for participating in today's Free Lunch Podcast. Let me pose my first question to both of you, but maybe, Jamie, you can respond first. My question to both of you is, why do you care about self-driving vehicles, and how are the two of you separately working on this issue? And one extra thing for you, Jamie, since you'll be leading us off, what exactly are we talking about? I've heard a number of different things about self-driving, autonomous, driverless, connected, or our listeners have. What exactly are we talking about, and what does self-driving mean? Jamie?
Sure, Devin. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be a part of this today. This is an area of particular passion for me and also for CTA. So CTA represents about 2,200 member companies, all aspects of technology, but we have a large component of companies that are working specifically in this space, from automakers like Ford and Mercedes to ride-sharing companies to Waymo and NVIDIA and chipmakers. So little bit of everybody that's really innovating in this space. And for us, for CTA, we see self-driving vehicles really as the number one, most I'd say, forward-looking, way to cut down on vehicle deaths across the country. Over 40,000 people are killed in vehicle accidents every year. 94% of those are caused by human error. And, this is really the first technology we've seen that can really cut that number down to close to zero. And we're excited about that, and also excited about the mobility options that that self-driving vehicles will provide, both for seniors and for disabled consumers. So we're really excited. And as you mentioned, all kinds of names out there for what we're calling self-driving vehicles. CTA uses self-driving vehicles pretty much exclusively based on a consumer study that we did that showed that is the term that consumers most understand and prefer, followed by driverless, autonomous, and very few who use the term robot cars, which is a term that I hate and will not ever use aside from this. But when we're talking about self-driving vehicles, really, what we're referring to and I'm referring to are vehicles that truly, do have the capability to drive themselves. There's a scale, a level of automation from 0 to 5, really level 0, 1, and 2 are not self-driving vehicles. They are driver assist. They have some features that are available now, all the way to, a Tesla autopilot. That is not a self-driving car. Self-driving vehicles start at level 3, 4, and 5, which means that the vehicle is fully capable of functioning on its own, of performing the driving task. And the lower levels of automation, level 3, would require a backup driver to be constantly, monitoring the driving situation and paying attention. Levels 4 and 5 are truly self-driving vehicles, and those are the highly automated self-driving vehicles.
Well, thanks, Jamie. And now I have a sense of what you mean and also why we refer to this technology in a certain way. I mean, I think it's probably pretty important, despite the fact that I think there might be and continues to, emerge, statistical evidence, and studies about how many, for example, lives could be saved by self-driving vehicles. But it's important, I think, to win the messaging or the communications battle as well in this space. So very, very interesting what CTA is doing. Ryan, do you have some thoughts on why you care and how you're working on this?
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you, Devin, and thank you to the Federalist Society for having me on the podcast. Looking forward to getting a little bit more in the weeds on some of these important issues. So like Devin indicated, I am the Director of Technology Policy at the Niskanen Center. We're a relatively new think tank and issue advocacy organization with an ideological bend somewhere on the moderate to moderate right of center spectrum. And my focus here is primarily on new regulatory governance models for emerging technologies. So technologies that don't really have any sort of historical precedent for regulation. So autonomous vehicles sort of is one of the most prominent mainstream examples I think most people have heard of with regards to technologies of this nature. I actually originally cut my teeth on this issue when I was first entering the technology policy space. The first law review article I ever published was at the Wake Forest Journal of Law and Policy. It was actually called Removing Roadblocks to Intelligent Vehicles and Driverless Cars. And so autonomous vehicles, or driverless cars, as we're going to be calling them in this podcast, kind of have a special place in my heart because it was the first real emerging technology issue and that I started looking at, as well as the various regulatory challenges surrounding the commercialization and research and deployment of these vehicles. So I care about these vehicles and this technology for a lot of the same reasons that Jamie just sort of pointed to, the possibility for greater mobility for, older populations and the, disabled members of our population, as well as the potential life-saving impacts that this will have. So it is an issue that is near and dear to my heart, and I have worked on it for many years before it suddenly became cool. So most of my focus is, while some of my focus is on legislative initiatives, a lot of my focus is actually on the Department of Transportation and, in particular, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and how they're thinking about future rules that they may be crafting surrounding driverless cars.
There we go. We got to win the messaging battle, Ryan. Come on. Self-driving.
Yeah. Self-driving.
I'm working on it. I'm working on it.
Well, you know, they stick you in a laboratory and you do writing for regulatory agencies and try to get them to remove hurdles in the way of this. So, but we're going to get to that as well. But I want to loop back to something, Jamie, that you said, and you mentioned levels of automation and what self-driving really means. I heard 3, 4, and 5. I wasn't sure whether there was a 1, 2, a 0, a 6, and a 7. What are the levels of automation? Could you go over that? And then maybe you can give us a sense of when, whether, I guess, some of these levels of automation are already on the road and when some of the higher levels of automation will actually be on the road.
Sure. So as I mentioned, the scale of levels of automation go from 0 to 5. So 0 is absolutely, you know, no features, no self-driving features. Level 1 would be what we call driver assist. So that would be things like your crash avoidance or lane keep assist, cruise control. Level 2 is a combination of those things. So like lane keep assist and crash avoidance. So a good example of what would be a level 2 vehicle on the road today would be a Tesla that's equipped with autopilot. And then levels 3 to 5 are really the levels that have the truly, you know, highly functioning automated driving systems. So level 3 is something where I mentioned before is kind of may require a handoff between the vehicle system and a human driver. So you still have the traditional auto design, steering wheel, gas pedal, mirrors, all of that. But you have a something that's more advanced than what a Tesla autopilot would be, where the vehicle can drive itself in most situations. However, could require, and I would say, you know, the easiest example of that would be highway driving. So it could drive itself on a highway, but perhaps, you know, when the vehicle exits a highway and goes into city driving, would require then the human driver to take over. Levels 4 and 5 are the highly automated levels. So level 4 would be the vehicle could totally drive itself in any situation within a geofenced area. And so you'd see Waymo is using level 4 vehicles in their testing in Arizona. So it's geofenced into a specific area, but you do not have to have a driver in the driver's seat to operate that vehicle. And level 5 is every situation covered. Never need a driver, don't need a steering wheel, brake pedal, all of those things. The vehicle will totally drive itself. And we're not quite there yet. There are different companies, doing testing in this area, but that's the one that's the kind of the holy grail of what we're trying to get to that will be quite a while still down the road. Level 3, level 4 is what's, I'd say, near term, coming in the near term that would be available for deployment when companies are talking about 2019, 2020, 2021 of having these vehicles on the road, having self-driving vehicles on the road. They're really referring to levels 3 and 4. Level 5 is going to require a lot more testing, a lot more data, and a lot more experience before we have something that is truly 100% operated by the advanced driving system.
Okay, thanks, Jamie. I mean, Ryan, do you have any additional thoughts or different thoughts, maybe a different take than Jamie here?
Actually, not at all. I think she hit the taxonomy right on the head there with the Society of Automotive Engineer levels. And part of the reason that part of the value of the SAE's levels of automation is to establish this sort of like clear taxonomy of uniform language so that we can all be speaking in the same language when we're talking about the specifics of various levels of automation. And I think Jamie, got it 100%.
Okay. Well then if we're on the same page here, then riddle me this. When we look ahead in planning how best to incorporate self-driving vehicles into our communities and lives, no matter, you know, when that actually is going to be, when those are going to be on the road, what are the biggest policy challenges? I'll throw one extra thing in here. I know neither one of you are lawyers, but to the extent that you've studied it and have some thoughts on it. What are the biggest legal challenges as well? So what are the biggest policy challenges to deploying this technology, and what are the biggest legal challenges to the extent that you have thoughts on that? Let's start with you, Ryan.
So I would say that one of the biggest challenges we have right now, and this is me focusing a bit more on sort of the level 5 fully autonomous vehicles, there's an awful lot of tricky challenges with regards to lower levels of automation where, you know, human operators may have to take control of the vehicle at some point, and that gets into a whole different level of complex challenges that we're likely to face. But one of the biggest challenges for the fully driverless car, the level 5, is sort of the safety standards at a high level. So like what we're actually considering safe in terms of a non-human operated, fully driverless car, that I think is the most pressing policy issue that we're going to have to confront with regards to this technology over the next 5 to 10 years as we get incrementally closer to being able to more safely deploy driverless cars that operate effectively without any sort of human operator at the helm of the wheel. And then, of course, there's the issue that occasionally rears its head depending on how focused we are on infrastructure spending at any given moment, which is how much sort of physical, you know, capital we need to invest in to ensure that these vehicles are talking to each other and aware of their surroundings. So a lot of people will bring up questions about whether or not there's a need to sort of install sensors in roadways, or if we need to, install, sensors in sort of like physical infrastructure. I tend to be a little more bullish on the technology that's actually in the vehicle itself. I think the only way that we're going to get an economical introduction of these vehicles en masse is if the vehicles themselves and the hardware that's actually on them are primarily what we need to ensure that they're safely operating on the roadways. And then, of course, there's the whole treasure trove of issues with regards to the comfort level of the American people, right? So there's this old kind of axiom surrounding new technologies where new technologies are introduced and we go through what people refer to as sort of like panic cycles. So you get a new technology and people aren't really familiar with it. It's not, you know, part of their daily lives, and sometimes it looks a little scary and they're uncomfortable with it. And then it's sort of that panic cycle sort of rises to a peak of hysteria where just, you know, it's Chicken Little and the sky is falling and, you know, the world as we know it is over. And then after you reach that peak of hysteria, things start to subside and eventually you reach a final inflection point where the technology just becomes a common part of everyday life. And you see this happen time and time again in history with pretty much any new technology, going all the way back to the camera in the late 19th century with RFID, which are radio frequency identification tags, when they were first introduced. And it's just even the radio and television sort of had this panic cycle with regards to their introduction into the commercial mainstream. So I think that aside from the regulatory challenges, just the getting people comfortable with this new technology is probably one of the biggest sort of sociocultural hurdles that we're going to need to overcome in order to actually see these vehicles kind of start to replace the traditional human-operated fleet of vehicles we have on our roadways right now.
Oh, very interesting. So, I mean, you cover a number of different things. Answer the question for sure. You know, what are the biggest policy challenges, and touched on legal challenges as well. But surprised me there with touching on market challenges, just sort of psychological challenges, I guess. Jamie, do you have some thoughts on the biggest policy challenges here?
Absolutely. And, I agree with everything that Ryan said. I think really the market challenges, the consumer education and understanding is a huge part of this. I think one of the most difficult, things that we've seen so far is for consumers to really understand what these vehicles do, what vehicles they have now are capable of. So, consumer, making sure that someone that owns a Tesla knows that autopilot requires you to still be paying attention. You cannot, turn and watch a movie while you're driving your Tesla. That's not a self-driving vehicle. And understanding, what what it means for safety, what it means for opportunity. There is definitely a bit of a fear factor out there on this technology. I mean, it's like Ryan said, you've seen this with products over the years throughout history. There is a concern and a fear of the unknown, and really just continued exposure to these vehicles, seeing them, you know, operate, you know, actually being in them, is what's going to eventually get people there and get people excited about them. I think the other hurdle that we run into that's starting to maybe have a little bit of an impact on conversations, especially on the Hill, is the impact on jobs. And that tends to come into play a bit more with commercial vehicles and trucks than it does with traditional passenger vehicles. But it is something that I think, you know, we're going to have to address head on is, you know, what do we do with, how do we deal with the displacement that will likely come from driverless trucks and from, you know, repair shops and auto dealers, depending on how business models change. There's definitely going to be a shift. And it's hard to predict exactly what that's going to be, but it is something that, you know, we are aware of and absolutely need to keep an eye on. As far as, you know, policy challenges now, our biggest concern from an industry perspective is consistency and having a strong national framework for expectations for these vehicles. We're starting to see a state patchwork emerge across the country on how different states are dealing with testing, dealing with requirements and regulations on vehicles and vehicle capabilities that it, at the end of the day is going to make it more difficult to deploy these technologies at a massive scale. You can't design a vehicle for California and design a different vehicle for Nevada and have that work in the marketplace. And, you know, you can't have a driver, you know, driving from California across the state line and all of a sudden their vehicle is not legal when they drive across the country. So those are definitely challenges. I mean, we've seen probably about 80 different bills across the country in this past session having something to do with self-driving vehicles, probably about 12 that would directly conflict with federal rules about what requirements there are for equipment. You know, at the end of the day, NHTSA, the federal government, regulates the performance standards for vehicles and what equipment needs to be in there. So seeing a little bit of mission creep from the states in this area where I think they see a void, they see something, you know, new and exciting, but eager to jump in and have their say on it, and that definitely creates some difficulties. So that's an area where we've really pushed both at the legislative level with Congress and the regulatory level with NHTSA and the Department of Transportation to say we need more clarity here and we need clear guidance to who is responsible for what in this technology.
Great response, Jamie, to the question, in part because your question bled right into another thought that I had, and I'll start with Ryan here and maybe you'll have some extra thoughts on this federalism question. I mean, so Ryan, what are your thoughts? What is the appropriate role or roles for federal, state, and local governments in regulating or promoting innovation in the deployment of self-driving vehicles? How do these various governments work together? What are their roles in this space?
So it's both an easy and a complicated question, depending on what in particular we're talking about. So last fall, Congress passed the Self-Drive Act and its companion legislation, the AV Start Act, in the Senate. Both would essentially establish rules of federal preemption regarding safety standards as they apply to, you know, to the concept of driverless cars. Sorry, I almost said autonomous vehicles, but driverless cars. We at the Niskanen Center have been very supportive of that approach. I have heard people argue that, you know, the federalist system works, the system of federalism we have in this country has worked pretty well as a means of, you know, promoting those laboratories of democracy. So, you know, one state maybe has less stringent rules for driverless cars. Another one has slightly more stringent rules. And in that way, we can sort of, you know, figure out like what works and what makes sense and what doesn't. The reality, though, and this, I think, is especially salient with recent announcements at the EPA, The reality is, like Jamie indicated, it doesn't make sense for an auto manufacturer or for a driverless car software designer to design and build, manufacture and deploy different vehicles based on different standards state by state. We have 48 contiguous states in this country, and moving across state lines creates uncertainty, legal and regulatory uncertainty, when the rules differ state by state. So what inevitably just ends up happening, I think, is whichever state ends up having the most prescriptive and prophylactic rules, that ultimately becomes by default the federal, the federal standards for safety. But going back to the self-drive and the AV Start Act, part of the reason that we at Niskanen are supportive of this approach is it recognizes the duly apportioned authority to the Department of Transportation and NHTSA in particular to be the safety regulator of record for vehicles in this country. That authority is already imbued with the Department of Transportation. It's there. Now, we can argue about whether or not it's too stringent or if that authority is better housed elsewhere, but that is currently, the state of affairs we're dealing with. And so in order to continue incentivizing the deployment of autonomous vehicles, even during this research and testing phase, it's important to establish certainty for those innovators that whatever designs they ultimately decide on and whatever standards ultimately may or may not apply to that technology, they're basically just going to have to comply with one set of standards rather than 48 or 50 potentially totally disparate disparate measures. So on that point, I think I'm largely in agreement with Jamie. The federalism concerns there may be issues with that, but just from a practical rollout standpoint, it only makes sense for the Department of Transportation to be the safety regulator of choice in this country for driverless cars, just as it has been the safety regulator of record for human-operated vehicles.
That's a very interesting response.
Sorry.
Please go right ahead.
No, I just wanted to follow up on that last point that Ryan made, and that is, the federal government and NHTSA is the safety regulator. At the end of the day, they regulate vehicles. States, localities regulate traffic laws. So, they regulate the human driver, what you can do in your vehicle, what the speed limit is, where you can park. And that's where I think, when you have a software system, when you have the vehicle is actually the driver, I think that's where you start to see this kind of mission creep from the states and the confusion of, do we regulate that or do they regulate that? I think as Ryan said, the system has been in place for traditional vehicles, and this is how it works. I think what the Self-Drive Act, the AV Start Act do, what industry is asking for is just consistency there, that the same model applies to self-driving vehicles as well.
Well, thanks for that follow-up, Jamie. I certainly think, this is kind of a really interesting point that Ryan makes and that you've comment on as well. I think if there is no federal standard here, there certainly are states who will step in to be the national regulators in this space. I'm not naming any names, but when it comes to self-driving vehicles and tailpipe emissions and the like, people will, there are states who will step into that void. So it's an interesting point. But to dovetail off of that, and I'll stop with my questions here pretty soon and turn to our audience and see what questions they have. I guess to you, Jamie, because I think you are sort of the legislative expert here, and I'll get to Ryan on the regulatory side, but what is Congress doing to address self-driving vehicles? I've heard the AV Start Act now. Or what is that, and what else is Congress doing?
Sure. So two separate bills. The Self-Drive Act is the bill that went through the House that was passed. The AV Start Act is the Senate bill that went through the Commerce Committee, still awaiting the full Senate consideration. The bills have some differences, but largely follow the same model, and that is dealing with the preemption question, so clarifying that, when the car is the driver, that the federal government, NHTSA, is the regulator, preserving states' rights on traffic flow and the same requirements that they've always had the ability to make. I think one exception to that was included in the Senate bill was a requirement that that states can't require licensed drivers in fully self-driving vehicles. And that's an important point because when one of the biggest reasons and supporters of this legislation is ensuring the increased use, the increased mobility options for folks that don't have driver's licenses now, the disabled, the blind. So making sure that states aren't requiring a licensed driver in a vehicle that doesn't need one is an important clarification to make. In addition to that, both bills increased the number of exemptions that manufacturers can apply for and receive from the current safety standards. I think, as Ryan will probably go into more detail on, there is a whole, vehicle safety code on, what the standards are for testing procedures, for what equipment vehicles need to have, where it needs to be. And a lot of these aren't going to apply to fully self-driving vehicles. So you have a lot of these vehicles now that would not actually meet the safety standard based on how they're written for a human-driven vehicle. Exemptions and increasing the number of exemptions is a way to deal with this issue in the interim where, you apply to NHTSA for an exemption from a certain safety standard and explain why and what the data is showing an equivalent level of safety, and then you get an exemption to be able to operate that vehicle. That's important to enable to get these vehicles, on the road to do the testing in real world conditions until, and this is another part of these bills, until NHTSA gets through the process of updating these safety standards, which, if you've ever worked with the federal government before, updating regulations takes years and years. It's not a quick process. So exemptions is really a way to kind of deal with that gap in time until we get a fully updated vehicle safety code that applies to self-driving vehicles. And I'd say, those are the highlights. There are a lot of other things contained in these bills with regards to requiring privacy plans and safety plans from cybersecurity plans from manufacturers. But those are really the key highlights of both of those bills. And we are definitely pushing and hopeful that the Senate bill gets through, gets full consideration, and gets a vote so that we can, put these bills together, come up with the standard and get it signed and really, move this forward.
Oh, thanks, Jamie. Pardon me. And to rewind just a little bit, speaking of working with agencies, particularly transportation and NHTSA, Ryan, that's what you do, at least in part. Can you give us a sense of what NHTSA is doing to address self-driving vehicles?
I can try to. It is a big question with many detailed subparts, but I'll try to just provide a general overview. So right now, the Department of Transportation is in the process of getting ready to release its third iteration of its Federal Automated Vehicle Policy Guidance, which basically details how the Department of Transportation is currently thinking about moving forward on the driverless car front. And we can probably come back to this in a little bit, but the short history here is in fall of 2016, they released their first guidance document under the Obama administration, and it was chock-filled with all sorts of proposed new authorities. The department maintained that it actually had a statutory authority to regulate software changes, the safety of software changes provided by manufacturers after a vehicle had already been sold to a consumer. A lot of people challenged that interpretation of the statute. They also proposed a new sort of pre-market approval authority, which we have not technically had in this country previously. So the idea is that DOT has to vet and then approve any new driverless car before it hits the road. And the plan for how exactly they were going to do this and what the standards were that would apply were very amorphous. And it was very clear that the department had absolutely no experience whatsoever sort of regulating software. And that's really what we're talking about when we're talking about the driver of a driverless car is a software algorithm. And so it produced a lot of worry in a lot of people's minds about whether or not the Department of Transportation was suddenly going to be claiming the authority to just regulate all software algorithms. Because a software algorithm, an artificial intelligence that's driving a driverless car, could, if you define AI or algorithm in a particular way, apply to all sorts of different swaths of the economy. Google's search function, for example, is technically a narrow form of artificial intelligence. It is an algorithm. So would DOT potentially be claiming authority to regulate Google search functions? A lot of that was very unclear. Fast forward to the Trump administration and the Department of Transportation under Secretary Chao, we got version 2.0 of that vehicle guidance document, which basically took a giant step back and said, okay, we went a little bit too far. Here's what we're actually thinking right now. And it was very much a much softer version of what we saw under the Obama administration. So it was chock full of voluntary guidance that manufacturers could abide by if they so chose. It explicitly noted to states that they should not use this guidance document as a template for legislation or regulation. So now where we're at right now is the department, having released that second version, is in the process of releasing its third version. And as part of that effort, they recently had a request for comments on specific federal motor vehicle safety standards that need to be changed in order to accommodate the introduction of driverless cars. And if you have a couple days of your time and you want to walk on over to Title 49 of the Code of Federal Regulations, Section 571, you can read through about 400, 450 pages of all of the various federal motor vehicle safety standards that currently apply to the manufacturer of automobiles in this country. And the trouble with all of these safety standards as they're written right now is the presumption in all of them is that there is a human driver facing forward in the vehicle. And so literally all of the FMVSSs that would apply to the manufacturer of new vehicles take that basic assumption that there's an actual human driver in the car, and all of the statutes are written around that. And so you get all sorts of very specific design type considerations, like how service brakes need to be activated by a foot control, a physical foot control. There's discussions about the specific amounts of Newtonian force that can be applied in the case of an accident. And based on where people are sitting, they shouldn't experience more than, you know, X amounts of newtons of force. And so it's basically it's kind of a little bit of a mess on the regulatory front, because there's no real way to easily change each and every single one of these FMVSSs to accommodate driverless cars. I went through, and the Niskanen Center actually submitted comments going through and looking at about a dozen different FMVSSs that definitely need to be changed. Everything from, you know, looking at where manufacturers needed to place warning labels on sun visors, and it's you can really get lost in the weeds on all this. But one of our recommendations was, look, maybe what you just need to do is provide an exemption for vehicles that are not human operated. Maybe what you need is a new FMVSS that explicitly exempts driverless cars from a lot of these historic statutes that we have on the books. So where we're at right now, I would say, is if you're a fan of driverless cars and if you want to see them introduced safely and effectively on American roadways, we're in a pretty good position, because the Department of Transportation now is very open to the reality that their current FMVSSs and their current regulatory approach, or I should say their historical regulatory approach to driverless cars, probably isn't going to make it any easier for the commercialization and deployment of these vehicles. So they seem now to be very committed to actually going through the Code of Federal Regulations, looking for what makes sense to keep and what makes sense to pitch and what needs to be changed. And they're very open to hearing from people about that right now, because it is kind of just a gargantuan lift for them that I think they do need a lot of direction. So I portend that over the next few months, after as we get closer to the third iteration of this guidance being released, it's going to be probably a good thing where we end up for a lot of driverless car manufacturers and developers. So the future is looking bright in the near to medium term, I think.
Brian, you led off with saying that this was both an easy issue to discuss, but also a complex issue. You certainly delivered on the complex side of that issue. No, but very, I mean, fascinating nonetheless. And thank you for your insights there. I'm going to go to audience questions here in just a minute. Let me get ready to do that. In a moment, everyone on the call is going to hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor to ask Jamie or Ryan a question, all you need to do is enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. I'm opening the floor now. Okay, floor request mode is on. Again, if you have a question for either Jamie or Ryan about self-driving vehicles, Ryan, enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. Before we get to some of the questions that I see already, I want to ask both of you, what have I missed? I know that there's a lot to talk about here, but is there something that for perpetuity we want to have on this recording today that I've missed, or do you have reactions to what you've heard from each other?
Well, I think, you know, this is Jamie, one thing that I'm sure someone probably already has a question about, so I'm jumping ahead of you here, but that I want to address is the fatality in Arizona last week. You know, the Uber accident with the pedestrian in the road that the vehicle didn't see, and which obviously, you know, our hearts go out to the victim and their family. Very unfortunate accident. Investigation still ongoing. You know, I think once the investigation is complete and we find out, you know, why this happened, you know, why the vehicle didn't stop, will be really, you know, kind of insightful for all of our members, for all of the companies working in this space to learn from and to, you know, see, you know, what that means for them and what improvements they need to make to their testing, to their vehicles, to ensure, to make sure that doesn't happen again. But I do also want to say that, you know, it's, we saw, I don't want to say we saw this coming. We knew at some point there was going to be a fatality that, you know, tied to self-driving vehicles, and that, you know, when it happened, what was that going to do, you know, to the development, to the regulatory and legislative space? And I think, you know, what we've seen so far, and what the long-term impacts are is, I think you've seen a couple companies take a step back and reassess their programs. But, you know, I think that there shouldn't be a, you know, kind of a rush to judgment that, you know, self-driving vehicles are bad, and that they're not safe. We're still in a very, very early stage of development here. You know, unfortunately, as I mentioned before, you know, accidents happen every day. We see, you know, 40,000 a year vehicle fatalities. And, you know, my hope and so far, you know, what I'm seeing is this, you know, this isn't putting a hard stop on the development of this technology. And, you know, I hope that, you know, we keep it in perspective, you know, that while the accident was unfortunate, you know, I, you know, hope that we learn from it and companies can make improvements to make sure something like that doesn't happen again. But there will be issues. There will be fatalities, way less, you know, than what we see by human drivers, you know, now. So I think it's important to keep a little bit of perspective there.
Thanks, Jamie. Yeah, I mean, we definitely have seen not only industry sort of pull back a little bit because of that, but we've seen state governments recoil as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think as you said, I mean, to some extent, this was expected. It is sort of, you know, here I am going off on a little bit of a tangent again, but it is interesting to sort of find out at some point, you know, how many deaths there were on the roadway during the testing of these vehicles that could compare to sort of this one fatality. Now it's you know drastically more, I'm sure. In any event, Ryan, did we miss anything that you wanted to discuss? Something important before we get to our first question?
I mean, the only thing that I'll offer in sort of passing mention is I realize there's probably a lot of lawyers on the line. And one of the questions that naturally rears its head when we talk about humans not being the operators of these vehicles in safety critical situations is how is liability apportioned, right? So there's a debate raging in academia right now over whether or not strict products liability should apply to sort of like software algorithms as they're used in self-driving cars. There, I finally got it. or whether or not we can eventually reach a point where a negligence standard could potentially be applied to a computer tortfeasor. I know we might get a question related to liability here, so I just kind of want to preempt it by saying that I don't have a good answer to this right now, and I don't think anyone really does. Usually my response is the common law has a pretty good way of working through tortfeasor claims. And, you know, right now, the big question that has to precede, I think, an assignment of liability is how exactly we're kind of defining a safe autonomous vehicle or a safe driverless car, or more specifically and more, you know, to the point, a safe algorithm that's actually doing the operating of the vehicle. And there are some interesting ideas out there. Honestly, I would direct a lot of people to Ryan Abbott at the University of Surrey School of Law. He has an interesting piece discussing this very issue about when we could actually potentially switch to a negligence standard rather than continuing to rely on a strict product liability standard. But I don't have any good answers to that. So I just want to sort of preempt that for any of the lawyers on the call who may be wondering about that question.
Let the record reflect that that question is preempted by Ryan Hagan at the federal level. Okay, thanks very much. Let's go ahead and head to our first question. I want to remind everyone else that if you have a question, all you need to do is enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. We'll get to your question in the order in which it is received. Caller, when we get to your question or get to you, you'll hear a prompt and you can ask your question.
Hi, this is Bill James with JPODS. And we've been working on autonomous vehicles for about 20 years. And I think it's an excellent federalist issue in that the Personal Rapid Transit Network in Morgantown, West Virginia, has delivered 110 million injury-free passenger miles. In that same period of time, 1.7 million Americans have been killed on roads. So autonomous vehicles like Morgantown, and you're going to see more of these with JPODS, we have a contract to deliver in China now, Hyperloop's coming out, but this whole view of access to rights of way for alternative networks for self-driving cars so that we can grade separate them and operate them over existing rights of way is a very important aspect of self-driving technology. How do we get that into the regulatory framework?
That's a great question, Bill. I think I've had conversations with some transportation folks about this, in fact, and I think that's actually me as a non-expert here, just discussing what I've or saying what I've heard. That's sort of the way these self-driving vehicles are going to sort of be introduced into the roadway, sort of their in a separate track, so to speak. Is that right, Ryan?
So I hear a lot. About these types of proposals, specifically like quarantining the self-driving cars off from sort of the rest of the roadway for at least safety and testing purposes. The trouble with sort of putting our cards in that basket is kind of twofold as I see it. One, the value of autonomous vehicles self-driving cars is specifically the fact that because the hardware is located on that vehicle, because it potentially doesn't require a build out of sensors and infrastructure and other heavy capital spending, the economical value here is that these vehicles could potentially simply be deployed on existing infrastructure. The moment we start to talk about, you know, segmented highways, segmented streets, we're talking about a very capital intensive economic build-out project. And you mentioned the Hyperloop. I'm pretty bullish on the Hyperloop. I think between the Hyperloop and the Boring Company, Elon Musk has a lot of like really good, nifty, innovative ideas for how to sort of update and sort of reform and innovate on our existing transportation networks. The trouble with all of these, though, is that they're very heavy in the capital expenditure. They take a long time to build. There's all sorts of competing regulatory issues with regards to right-of-way between, you know, state lines, with, you know, on the Hyperloop issue in particular, you know, circumventing, you know, underground pipes and things of that nature. And the value for me of self-driving cars currently, the potential value that they have is they could be good enough to just deploy on the infrastructure we already have built out. And the other issue that I would mention is one of the, and maybe Jamie can talk a little bit more about this, but you know, from what I can tell, what a lot of these companies are really focusing on is researching and testing these vehicles in sort of real-world roadway conditions so that they can accumulate the necessary amounts of data to improve on the algorithms, to make them safer, and to make them more equipped to be effectively deployed on the roadways. So the moment we start kind of segmenting self-driving cars away from the rest of the human-operated fleet, we don't get the same type of data necessary to improve on the algorithmic models we need to improve on to make them safe enough to deploy with the rest of the human-operated fleet. Because, again, and this issue, though it may seem sort of, you know, relatively obvious, often gets lost in the debate, we're not just going to wake up one day and all of a sudden the entire American roadway fleet is going to be completely, you know, self-driving or autonomous. Like there is going to be a transition period where there's going to be human-operated vehicles alongside self-driving cars. And we need to be sure that the self-driving cars are capable of dealing with various, you know, safety-critical situations that may emerge as a result of the, you know, many, many mistakes that human-operated vehicles make on the roadway. So personally, I'm not huge on, you know, investing in heavy capital infrastructure development projects that would, you know, basically, you know, move self-driving cars away from, you know, the existing roadways.
Yeah, I didn't mean to say that we should do that. More along the lines that access to rights of way have been forbidden, basically. If you look at Massachusetts Senate Bill S-1970, it allows alternative networks like J-Pods and Hyperloop to be built based upon a standard if you're five times more efficient than existing networks and pay 5% of gross revenues, then you can build over existing rights of way to build grade separated rails. But I think that you're correct in that, and as we build these networks, our view is there will be a tremendous number of what we call sublethal vehicles, vehicles that are designed to go 15, 20 miles an hour, cross-connecting things from end stations that will be self-driving, that will operate on the city streets. But the problem is getting governments to allow rights-of-way access for alternative networks is blocked by Department of Transportation, since if you read the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment Study, PB-244854, which was published back in 1974, it outlined that DOT was likely the barrier to developing alternative networks. And that's my point is, how do we get the regulatory framework to allow both self-driving cars and alternative self-operating networks?
I see. Honestly, I haven't looked too deeply into that issue. Maybe Jamie can talk more about it. I would say that with the current DOT secretary and this current administration, it seems like those are the types of regulatory reform proposals that would be appealing to them, specifically because they address issues that DOT has the authority to deal with sans any sort of legislative action. But maybe I'm missing something. Jamie, do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I haven't really gotten any additional expertise in that space. I would just, following up on Ryan's point, I advise you to reach out to DOT. These are exactly, you know, they put out, I think, four different requests for comment recently on barriers for self-driving vehicles and for, you know, for alternate means of transportation and innovation. They're really, you know, looking for those kind of examples. So I would highly suggest that you reach out to them and submit comments to them on that point.
Well, great. Bill got a bit of a twofer there, but good questions and great responses, Ryan and Jamie. I'm going to make one final call for questions. If you're interested in asking a question, asking a question of Jamie or Ryan, Interstar and the pound or your telephone keypad. In the meantime, I'm going to make an announcement. The Regulatory Transparency Project will have a luncheon event on emerging technology in transportation, not only ground transportation, but air transportation, but maybe even sea transportation. No date is set yet, but within the next couple of weeks, there will be a date set. It's open to anyone interested in these issues, which I presume is most people on this call. Keep an eye on the regproject.org website for our announcement and details, or even better, we'll ping you if you're subscribed to our newsletter or if you follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn once we announce the date of that event, the time of that event, and other details. So subscribe to our newsletter, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Okay, seeing no additional questions, I want to ask Jamie and Ryan if you have any final thoughts for our listeners. Again, this is the Free Lunch Podcast, so this is going to be posted on our website, and folks who are not on the call now will be listening as well. Is there anything you'd like to share in terms of closing thoughts?
I would just say, you know, again, thank you so much for having Ryan and I on. This has been really, you know, it's a fun topic to talk about. There's so much innovation going on in this space. You know, it's something different every day. So, you know, thank you for having us. I'm really optimistic about this technology and where it's going. I hope you are too. And if folks on the call are active in this space, interested, please feel free to reach out to me. My Twitter is at Jamie Boone. I'm at the Consumer Technology Association again. So, love to hear from you.
Yeah, I'll just reiterate everything Jamie said. It was a pleasure to be on this call. I'm happy that the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project afforded us this opportunity to sort of talk about how Jamie and I are thinking about some of these emerging tech issues as they relate to self-driving cars. Just to reiterate, going off of Bill's question, this is the time to start submitting any sort of comments or ideas for innovative new policy proposals that, could usher in the next wave of innovative transformations of the U.S. transportation infrastructure. This is a department that is very open to deregulatory actions for obvious reasons. And so if you have ideas to that effect, I would highly suggest you take a look at some of the requests for comments that DOT currently has listed on their website and on regulations.gov. Otherwise, if you have ideas that you think definitely merit consideration by my organization or by me personally, please feel free to reach out. I'm not sure if my contact info is on the RTP website. If not, you can reach me at rhageman@niskanencenter.org, and I'm happy to hear from folks whenever.
Well, with that, on behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, I want to thank our audience. And, of course, again, thank you, Jamie and Ryan, for joining us on the Free Lunch Podcast today. I think we'll leave any weekend study of the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards for now to Ryan. But hopefully we'll see everyone else again, maybe at our Emerging Tech Summit within the next couple of weeks, but stay tuned for that. Until we meet again, so long, everyone. Goodbye.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to Free Lunch. As always, you can subscribe on iTunes and Google Play to get new episodes of Free Lunch when they're published. Also, visit our website at regproject.org. That's REGproject.org. There, we regularly upload content in addition to our podcasts, such as short videos and papers. And you can join the discussion by sharing your story of how regulation has personally affected you. Until next time, remember, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.